baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. It's been a while. We've been busy over here. I've been doing our podcast here on minorleagueball.com and also on our Facebook page. And a little bit of writing, a little bit of a lot of other stuff. Fantasy world's going on. So it's a lot of craziness here as we finished up September and entered into October. So it's been a podcast kind of hiatus over the last few weeks. But we got a lot to get to, and we're going to do the best we can to cover as much as we can. We're not going to go on and on and on and on forever, but we're going to try to get to as many topics as we can, and there's a lot. I know Buck Showalter in the wildcard games have been analyzed to death probably about a week and a half ago, but I do want to get George Kurtz's take on it. He's going to be joining us today. He's a fantasy writer over at rotoexperts.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at George Kurtz. I always like getting his baseball takes. And again, I know that the Buck Showalter thing is not timely. It's not brand new. But the fact that he didn't put in Zach Britton in that game, that's a pretty big topic. And I figured since we haven't discussed it on this podcast yet, I want to at least get into it a little bit. We're not going to break it down for 45 minutes or anything like that. But I do want to get George Kurtz's opinion on it. Because how you handle the bullpen, I think essentially that's what determines whether someone considers you a good or bad manager. Lineups. You know, sometimes people have complaints with him. John Farrell got criticized pretty significantly going into game one because he had Brock Holt hitting second. How is Brock Holt batting second? Anyone who's watched the Red Sox knows that while at times he's a nice player, but batting second, what are you doing? Well, Brock Holt was probably the only good Red Sox player offensively, or at least one of very few in the first series. So John Farrell just gets torched up here in Boston. He goes from last to first. They have a great season, and yet he just gets criticized constantly. And a lot of it's justified. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to sit up here and defend John Farrell. I don't think he's a great nose manager. But then he puts in Brock Holt to bat second, and he goes out and has the best series of maybe any offensive player on the team, or at least one of. And I don't see a lot of people praising him. And a matter of fact, analysts up here in Boston were preparing for that possibility to happen. So they were saying, I can't believe Brock Holt is batting at the top of the lineup. And even if he plays well, it's still a bad decision. That was what they were saying, which I understand. I do that all the time too, but it's a cover your ass kind of move. You can't criticize a guy for a move, and then when it works, tell him you don't get credit for it. I mean, that at least partially, that's not fair. And it's a short series, and you got to go with things. And so, again, I didn't think that Brock Holt should be batting second either, so I'm not going out here and praising myself or anything. But nonetheless, how a manager does things with the bullpen is probably the most important part of it. And Buck Showalter, who I've praised on the show very many, many times, I didn't understand that move. Nobody seems to understand that move. And for a great manager to make such a diabolical disaster of a decision, I at least want to get George Kurtz's take on it. The same thing can be said for Bruce Bochy. I think most people consider Bruce Bochy the best manager in baseball. If he's not the best, if you're afraid to name anyone as the best, you have to at least say he's considered one of the top few anyway. And you look at his bullpen and you look at the disaster, and that's one of the issues too. I do believe that how you handle the bullpen is probably the biggest factor in people's opinions of you as a manager. I don't think it probably should be. It's not fair because of the analytics of the world that we live in now, and all these Ivy Leaguers are getting into sports analysis and they look at numbers. And so if you can't prove something with a number, they disregard it almost whole out of hand completely. But at the very least, they disregard it significantly. And so when you look at teams like Terry Francona has become a pretty good X's and O's guy. But he wasn't always. He made some really head-scratcher kind of decisions when he was here in Boston that I really wondered about sometimes. But he's become a very good X's and O's guy. John Farrell obviously criticized significantly for his moves quite often. But when you look and you see how a bullpen is performing, I think you got to look at things and say, you know, you can't blame Bruce Bochy for the fact that his guys just can't get anybody out after the eighth inning. The same thing goes for when I was talking about with the Francona point was getting your guys to perform matters. One of the reasons why Francona is in Cleveland and not in Boston is because he completely and totally lost the clubhouse in Boston. He was letting them drink during the games. There was coaches and himself included were hitting on reporters. I don't know what kind of example that sets when these young players are coming up through the system and they're seeing the manager hitting and having sex with reporters. I mean, I don't know what kind of example that sets. That's private life. I guess it shouldn't matter. but I think it probably does. And John Farrell had that same issue here, too, this year. So I don't know if John Farrell's lost the clubhouse or not, but how you handle the clubhouse and whether you can get players to perform. Managers deserve credit for that, and they don't. Dusty Baker is scorched for being a horrible X's and O's manager and that he actually destroys bullpens. I remember Joe Torre used to get criticized for that all the time. He just ran whatever bullpen arm he liked, he just ran them into the ground until they died. You know, and even then he wasn't willing to shoot them. He still put them out there for 80 innings a year. But when you have a bullpen and you don't trust anybody, you can kind of understand why someone does that. But it is what it is, and so we'll get into some of those. We'll talk about the wild card series. We'll talk about the division series. We'll look ahead to the Cubs. We'll talk a little bit about David Ortiz and Javier Baez, and we'll give our World Series predictions as of how things are looking right now. Let me bring George Kurtz into the program. George, great to have you on board again. Before we get into baseball, you must be excited. Hockey's up and running. You're the big hockey guy, referee. You must be on cloud nine today.
Well, this is one of my favorite weeks of the sports season. You know, you got the baseball playoffs in high gear. We're in week six of the NFL season. And as you mentioned, hockey's on tonight. Hockey opening night is tonight. And hockey has a whole landscape to itself. Right? The American League did the NHL a great favor. No game fives. Basketball is not here. No NFL tonight. It's all about pucks.
And one thing that I don't know why more people aren't fans of hockey. I mean, they have plenty of fans, don't get me wrong. But they are clearly, without a doubt, at probably the third or fourth sport, and it's not really all that close. But hockey is awesome. I mean, hockey is fast, it's physical, and it has the benefits of the NFL. It has some of the similar strategies of the NBA, only it's not as slow and boring, and hockey players actually care. My biggest issue with basketball isn't basketball, because I enjoy basketball. I like to play basketball. But it's so boring, it's so slow. It's so one-dimensional, and the guys take off like 70, 80% of the game for 70 or 80% of the season. There's no drama or intensity to it. Hockey is more physical than the NBA. It's a lot faster than the NBA. It's not quite as physical as the NFL, of course, because that's like a car wreck on every play. But it's physical like the NFL. But yet they actually care. I mean, they do take nights off sometimes. They get exhausted. But for the most part, there's an intensity to hockey most every night that just doesn't exist in the NBA.
No, it's a fast-paced game. I think I understand why it's not as popular here as I think it should be. It's hard to follow the puck. A lot of games are low-scoring. Hockey is trying to fix this somewhat. What they come up to with, like the goalie pads, streamlining and making them smaller, that's nice. They probably do need to make the nets bigger eventually to get more a little more offensive action here. But as you mentioned, it's physical. It's fast. It's sometimes it's beyond me why people don't like it as well. But I'm guessing we don't see the players' faces. I think that's another thing. You know, the hockey doesn't market the game very well. They've taken fighting out pretty much. You know, 90% of the fights are gone, so we don't see those battles anymore. Everyone wears a shield nowadays. So it's I get it why it's not. But you mentioned, sure, there aren't as many hits in hockey as there are in football, but whether those hits are more violent than football. And you're on skates, you're going 20, 25 miles an hour, you're hitting other players who don't even see you coming. Those are car crashes. All right, so it is in some ways it is more violent than football, but hey, it is what it is. It's a redheaded stepchild of sports and fantasy sports. But yes, I'm still excited that it's back tonight.
Yeah, I mean, and the one thing about the playoffs, if I could actually complain about it, the NHL playoffs to me are without a doubt. Other than the majors, I'm a golf guy. I love the majors in golf. I'm an unabashed adorer of the majors. So that is my favorite event. But that's 4 days, three times a year, because one of the other majors is a little weaker. But four majors a year in golf, 4 days each. I love those. Those are my favorite 16 days of the year. So I know I'm very much in the minority there. But on the whole, the NHL playoffs are by far and away the best event of the season, of any sport. The Super Bowl does not compare, in my opinion, to how good the NHL playoffs are. Nothing compares, in my opinion. Even March Madness. I love March Madness. But NHL playoffs, the only thing I would complain about it is it's so good, it's so intense. My heart can't take it. When the Bruins are fighting for a Stanley Cup, I'm dying. I'm like, oh, my goodness. Because it's so fast, so much is going on. And if you care about the team even a little bit, it's just heart-wrenching. It's like I'm almost glad it's over, or I'm almost glad my team gets eliminated because I don't have to go through the stress of these seven-game series. It's that intense and that dramatic. I'm not exaggerating that much. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but – people who don't realize it, the NHL playoffs are just plain awesome.
You'll get no argument from me. And there's nothing better in sports than overtime playoff hockey. That is just psychotic. Yeah. You'll be on the edge of your seat if you're a fan of the team. Your nails are gone, and you're gripping the nearest person or thing, and you're gripping it to shreds. It's just it's a different animal. It's just a different animal. Playoff hockey. It's great. It's next. You don't know what's going to decide the game for you. There is something about it. The season can drag on. It is a long season, 82 games. I mean, you think about it. By the time the regular season ends in hockey, opening day in baseball will have begun.
That's one thing. The playoffs go on for a long time, and I don't complain about it because it is, like you said, playoff hockey is just plain. Overtime hockey specifically is incredible. But it does go on for a long time, and I don't even care about it because I just want more games. So I want them to keep going. Even hockey's the ones, but even baseball. I like following baseball, and obviously we're going to get to baseball here in a minute on a podcast later here. But I don't watch I like following baseball more than actually watching it. I enjoy watching baseball games. I don't want anyone to get the impression that I don't. But I follow the stats. I look at how players are doing. I like some of the highlights in baseball more. Hockey playoffs, I don't care who's playing. At 7 o'clock Eastern time until like 2 in the morning when the West Coast playoff games end. I watch hockey the entire time, and I don't care who it is. And I am not a crazy hockey advocate. You are a much bigger hockey fan than I am. I don't watch a ton of games during the regular season. I don't watch the Bruins every single night. I watch the Red Sox almost every single night. I don't watch the Bruins every single night. I don't watch out-of-town, non-related to who I like games. I'm not a huge hockey guy. But when the playoffs are going on, I watch every single minute that I can get until I just can't stay awake anymore. That's how good the playoffs are. They make you want to watch it, even though you don't care at all. It's just that good. It's just that dramatic. It's just that fast-paced. I can't even emphasize how awesome playoff hockey is, and it's great that it's finally got going now.
Absolutely. We have 4 games tonight, and I'll be watching all 4.
All right, now we're going to start getting to some baseball here on a podcast to be in later. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. Joining me today is George Kurtz. And while we went off on our tangent a little bit with playoff hockey, let's get back into the reality of the baseball world. And let's touch on a subject that, again, it's been thoroughly analyzed, but I do want to get your take on it. Buck Showalter had 4 chances to bring Zach Britton into the game. Instead, he brought in Bratt. He brought in O'Day. I forget the 3rd pitcher that he brought in, but he was a lesser pitcher, to say the least. And then he brought in Ubaldo, Dentzing, that's right. That's the name I couldn't remember. And then he brings in Ubaldo, who was just throwing meat up there. I mean, they might as well have been hitting off a tee. He was so easy. There are interesting arguments to be made for every one of those calls. And I agreed with some and not so much with the others. But I'm curious, how do you think he handled that game with those 4 relievers, decision by decision, to go with them rather than going with Zach Britton?
Well, I think what it comes down to is this. You bring in Brock, what a great season. Okay, I'd have an issue with that. O'Day, all right, I was good with that. I think Dentzing is where I draw the line. Now you're talking an average pitcher at best. You're not playing a team that can't hit here. This might be different if you were playing a team that, let's say like an Oakland A's type of team that got into the playoffs and really can't hit, but they're in it because of good pitching, something like that. Okay, then I can sort of see this, where you're saving your reliever. But Chris, if I'm going to lose, if I'm going down, there's no way my best pitcher on the team, not my best reliever, my best pitcher on the staff is not pitching. No way. That's not happening. Especially a guy I could use for multiple innings. I'm guessing Britton was good for at least 2 innings, maybe 3. Yeah, there's just no way. That's a bullet in the chamber. You didn't pull. You didn't use. To me, that's crazy. I was shocked. Absolutely shocked when I saw Dentzing on there, because I see Brock and I know I tweeted a couple of things I think something like, we really are a slave to the save rule. I'm tweeting stuff like that, but then I get, okay, Brock, O'Day, not a big issue. Then I'm like, I say, okay, now he brings in Britton, right? Now he's going to, no, it's Dentzing. Okay, and he got lucky there, right? He survived there, and then it's Jimenez. And I get the logic that Buck's going with Jimenez, that he had pitched well down the stretch, but that it was as a starter, not as a reliever. Completely different animal there. We see this over and over again. Hell, we see relievers who can't pitch, close who can't pitch as setup men. More or less a starter trying to pitch as a reliever. And maybe that was the thinking there, too, that Britton wouldn't be good not closing a game just by the setup man. But, I can't lose that way, Chris. I just can't lose that way. I would have been okay if Brock or O'Day. He probably still gets some criticism, but at least those guys were good relievers. Dentzing, come on. You can't even remember his name. That's a nobody. It's an average reliever. Jimenez is not even a reliever. I can't go down that way. I can't lose. I can't have my season end with my best pitcher. I'll say it again, best pitcher, starter or closer, not getting in the game. Can't happen.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, and I like how you parsed it out between the Brat and the O'Day and the Dinsing and the Ubaldo Jimenez. And I do know who Dinsing is. He pitched for the Twins before now pitching mediocre for the Orioles. I actually thought that maybe Brock should have gone longer. I remember seeing on Twitter at the time that some people were saying as soon as Brock got in a little bit of trouble, you have to bring Britton in. And to me, I guess the easiest way to try to frame it is Brock and O'Day, I think, are benefits. They're assets. Those are guys who, if you had to put one batter in against a pitcher, O'Day and Brock are going to win that battle more often than not, a lot more often than not. So I want those guys going as many innings as I can. So for them, having them in there is actually in the Orioles' favor over the Blue Jays. Once you go to Dinsing, and I can understand maybe wanting, you know, you're getting greedy. Buck was getting greedy trying to have Dinsing in there, and then he got extremely greedy, and obviously it cost him his hand and his mouth and everything else when he tried to get by with Jimenez. But with Brock and O'Day, I think you're better off. And I almost thought they should have tried to get more innings. Because one of my arguments was the fear of bringing in Britton for Brock is that the game had to go two more innings. I mean, I don't believe that you should save your guy until he gets the save. But if you bring in Britton and you cut off Brock, then you lose Brock for one out, two outs, three outs, four outs. Maybe Brock goes three innings and gets you an extra six outs beyond when people were screaming for Britton to be in. That could have killed you. This game had to go at least two more innings. So to bring up Brock, I thought would have been a mistake. And the same thing for O'Day. If you want to have O'Day after Britton, I don't have a problem with that. But O'Day is a top-tier reliever. He got the double play and got them out of it. And you maybe want to get a couple innings from him. I don't have a problem with bringing Britton after that. But exactly what you said. Once you start that next tier of guy, all of a sudden it becomes a game where the Jays are favored over the Orioles. And that's when I bring Britton in and you let him go as far as you can. And then you just got to throw your hands up and say, look, I've got no more. All right, I have to bring Dinsing in. I have to bring Jimenez in. And I agree with you completely. That's how you had to handle it. He warmed up in the eighth inning, Britton did. And I wondered if maybe he was injured and Buck is covering for him. And that seems to me, all the PR statements, everything has been said. No one has even implied that he's been injured. That, to me, seemed more likely after the game. I guess at this point I have to accept the public stance, which is, no, Britton was fine. He was just waiting for a save situation. That's what it was. But Showalter's such a good manager. I still have a hard time swallowing that. I mean, it was such a colossal mistake. And it was a two-pronged mistake, like you said. Bringing in Dinsing was probably a mistake. And bringing in Jimenez and then leaving him in there, I mean, you could see that Jimenez was giving it up. I knew that Encarnacion was hitting a home run there. I mean, that was a foregone conclusion. Everybody watching that game thought that was going to be a homer, didn't they? I mean, that's two big-time mistakes by one of the best managers in the game. I still have a hard time believing that Britton was 100%, even though they've said it, and I guess I have to accept it. But, I mean, those are two colossal mistakes from a guy that I know you respect that I think is one of the best managers in the game. I still have a hard time believing that Britton was 100% healthy.
Yeah, that's something I tweeted out as well, Chris. I thought the same thing. Britton must have an injury. He must be hurt. But nothing came out. Britton came out and said he could have pitched. He was fine. He was disappointed that he didn't get in the game. That was seen to indicate he wasn't. You know, Buck told us his logic. I don't agree with it. But as you mentioned, I do think Buck Showalter was one of the best managers in the game, which just makes this even more psychotic to me, more silly that he would make this move that you would never see Buck make. I can't believe, Showalter, once again, will be the slave to the save rule. I just don't see him being that kind of manager. So it was surprising. It was just as surprising. If there was an injury to Britton, well, then that's fine. Then we all understand it. We all get it then. It makes perfect sense. But from everything I've heard, there was no such injury.
Yeah, and we saw the oddity of Osuna having to leave earlier in the game because he had what turned out not to be an injury, but just something didn't feel right. He had a stretch in his shoulder, and he's still pitching him. He's still pitching with it, and Gibbons is working him into the ground, even though he has it. But even still, you saw him leave the game in a crucial moment. If Britton was injured, I don't see any problem why you wouldn't admit it. But, again, maybe it doesn't look good. And Buck Showalter seems like the type of guy that would be covering for his players. And if Britton was injured, I don't think anyone would blame him. I mean, if you're injured, you're injured. But we have that discussion. We're a social media world. We're, to some degree, a hater world. I'm writing an article about that as we speak. And I wonder if there's nothing you can do now. admitting that Britton had something tweaked in him and didn't feel right, you're going to get questions about, well, you got to give it up for the team. You got to go out there and try. Even if that's completely unfair, that would have been a discussion that came out if anybody admitted that Britton was, in fact, injured. I mean, he was warming up in the eighth. He pitched fine just a few days ago. And then all of a sudden now, in the most important moment of their season, he can't pitch. He would have been criticized. I could understand why they would be covering for him. It wouldn't be fair. If a guy's injured and he can't pitch, he can't pitch. But let's face it, we're not a fair society. There would have been a lot of analysis and said, look, Zach Britton's just not a team player. This guy's soft. You know that would have come out from at least some people.
Yeah, it was like I said, in a one-game playoff, all the rules go out the window. I'm sorry, man. You got to win. You lose, you go home. You're on the golf course. You're on vacation. I don't care if pitching guys multiple innings. You do what you got to do to win the game. So unless there's an injury here, it's still bothers me now. I'm not a Baltimore Orioles fan. It still bothers me now. They lost a one-game playoff without using Britton. And it wasn't like Britton had pitched the day before. They used him for two innings on a Monday, and they couldn't afford to put him in there. That wasn't the case either. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, and then it just culminated the worst. I mean, Jimenez looked awful. He was throwing meatballs up there. I don't know. Did you think that Encarnacion was going to hit a home run? Because I thought it was a fact. I thought everybody knew that the way Jimenez was throwing, Encarnacion was hitting a home run. I knew that was going to happen. And I don't consider myself a genius for predicting it. It was just so obvious with all the energy in the building, with how poorly Jimenez was throwing. Those were just meatballs. There was no velocity, no movement. There was nothing on that. You literally could have put it on a tee, and Encarnacion would have been less likely to hit a home run than on that pitch. It really looked like batting practice. How you leave Britton in the bullpen when you know Buxton had to be sitting there, and he had to know that Jimenez was going to give up at least a hit. I mean, you could watch that game. You just had to know that there's no way Jimenez was getting Encarnacion out, and there's no way he was getting out of that inning. It just was never going to happen. It was so obvious. That's what makes it even more difficult, is it was so obvious. I mean, if someone goes to you and says, you are going to lose this game. If the baseball gods came down and said, Buck, if you leave Jimenez in right now, you're going to lose the game, would Buck say, okay, I'm going to lose the game? Well, no. He would do something else. And it seems that obvious. It seems that obvious that Jimenez was going to give up the game.
He was throwing flat fastballs pretty much right down Broadway or right into where you know that they know they want to crank it. I don't know if I was predicting a home run. I certainly was predicting a Blue Jays victory. So at the very least, I guess, sack fly or a hard hit ball somewhere. I'd have probably walked Encarnacion. He'd been hot, having a good year. I'd have pitched to Bautista. But that being said, I don't think the outcome's any different.
No, that's probably true. looking ahead to the Mets and the Giants in that wild card game, anything stand out for you for that one that was meaningful, or were you surprised? Did you expect to win that game, or did that one go as it could possibly go?
Well, I didn't expect to win the game because I didn't play. So it wasn't what we thought it would be. Right? A low-scoring game, pitching dominated. Syndergaard and Bumgarner. It was a fun game to watch, tough game for the Mets to lose. Not shocking at all. I guess you worry about Familia a little bit, right? Had another great regular season. Blows a save in the playoffs. Now, you wonder if that takes a toll eventually. I guess in some ways you can't win the big one. You can do it the regular season. Not all the blown saves were his fault last year against the Royals in the World Series, but this one sure was.
Yeah, and looking at the Mets team, they got a lot of credit for doing what they were able to do with all those injuries. And I predicted the Mets would miss the playoffs altogether, and that was with a healthy rotation and a healthy team. So I guess I should probably cry uncle and say that the Mets far exceeded my expectations. And I have explanations and reasons why. I wrote an article on the Mets for minorleagueball.com and how they were able to do what they did this year, even though they ended up with less wins. They did have one of, if not the best record in the National League, I believe, in the second half of the season, or at least August and September. So they turned it all around and really played well, just like they did last year. If this team was healthy, or let's just say they won the wild card, what would your opinion have been of the Mets going into the division series? Would you think of them being better than Nationals, better than the Cubs, better than the Dodgers? If they had been able to get by that one-game sudden-death day against Bumgarner, maybe the best playoff pitcher of all time. I mean, that's what they're kind of putting that label on him. Would you have been more highly on the Mets maybe than some of the other teams, or was this a one and done and then they were probably going to lose?
No, I think they were one and done no matter what. Now, I did make pick the Mets, and back when you and I talked in March, we made our predictions. I did pick the Mets to make the playoffs. But that being said, when we talked in, let's say, August, I said the Mets wouldn't make the playoffs. Because when the Mets, everybody got hurt. I mean, everybody got hurt. Now, people would say, oh, they had an easy schedule. Okay, down the stretch they did. They played nobody. But, hey, that means they had a tough schedule the first 4 months. You know, they survived it. You want to tell me that the St. Louis Cardinals choked down the stretch by losing to Cincinnati over and over again? Not going to argue with you. I believe they did. You know, same thing with the other teams battling for it. They didn't play very well. You know, Miami Marlins, okay. They had a tough situation with Jose Fernandez, and they may not have been all that very good. May not have been all that good anyway. Pittsburgh fell apart. But St. Louis definitely had their issues. Probably showed were the better team, but in the end, didn't play better. So I think the Mets deserve credit. I think all the injuries the Mets have had. I mean, it was almost like they had that sniper up in the light stands taking out pitchers. Matt's gone. Harvey, gone. You know, DeGrom, gone. You know, it's like, when was something going to happen to Syndergaard? The sniper tried. You know, he has the elbow injury. It looks like he missed a little bit. You know, when Bartolo clones your number two starter, you know, that's just crazy. I think the Mets do deserve some credit for doing what they did. But that being said, if they would have won, which they could have, because it was going to be a pitcher's duel, they could have easily won that 1-0, something like that. If they would have won, I think the Cubs would have pretty much ran roughshod over them.
Yeah, and I'm a little conflicted because one of the reasons why when I wrote my article about the Mets over at minorleagueball.com, I didn't praise them because, again, I thought they were going to miss the playoffs, and I still think they probably could have or should have missed the playoffs, but they did obviously get in. One of the main reasons why they did get in is because the Pirates not only had a disappointing season, but they won 20 less games than last year. So if the Pirates are going to win 20 less, those wins have to go somewhere. But a lot of them didn't go to the Cubs, didn't go to the Mets. So that's part of my argument, but it's not the strongest one, and really the weakest one, and probably which hurts my case that the Mets didn't belong in the playoffs, was that the East actually did get better. That was my argument why they were going to miss the playoffs, was that they were so weak outside of their division in 2015, and they were so good in their division because the NL East were just so bad last year, that the improvement of the NL East was going to keep them out. They were going to probably lose 6 to 8 more games this year than last year because the East was going to be better. And that actually happened. They ended up winning about 4 less games, and so that's why they got in. If they had lost 6 or 8, they would have missed it. But because they only lost 4, they got in. But the Pirates went from 98 wins to, I believe, 78 wins. So that 20 wins went somewhere. And so that was kind of my argument. So maybe they deserve it. Maybe the fact that they still made the wild card, even though their division got better, that's probably reason for praise. Let's get to the division series, and let me ask you about the Giants. I was watching Chris Russo on the MLB Network the other day, and he was talking about how this game was crucial for the Cubs. Because if they had to go to Game 5 to Chicago with all the expectations and all the history and everything going along with the Cubs, that would be a really tough spot for the Cubs to win. And I think Bumgarner probably would have been pitching if they had a Game 5. That would have been I couldn't believe that the Giants were in this series. But when you saw what happened in the ninth innings of both of these last two games, I'm curious about, A, how good the Cubs are, and B, what is going on with this Giants team? How did they almost pull this off?
Well, when you saw the game, I agree with Russo that I think it would have been more pressure on the Cubs than Giants. You know, all the curse, and he's talking about GOAT and all the bad luck and Bartman and everything else. So there would have been a lot of pressure on the Cubs. I think it would have been Johnny Cueto starting with Bumgarner maybe pitching a few innings in relief. I can't see how he could pitch, how he could start the game and be all that effective. We saw Kershaw, though, pitch well yesterday. Didn't pitch great on 3 days rest. It just generally doesn't work out. But it would have been Cueto, and I think the pressure would have been on the Cubs, and would have been on there pretty immensely. You know, it would have been interesting to see how they handled that. That being said, they probably should have won Monday night when they blew the 3-run lead in the ninth instead of the Giants over 3-run lead last night. I think the better team did win. So baseball-wise, I think that's a good thing. I think the TV networks are maybe a little upset about the Giants winning. They're probably thrilled. If their Toronto and Cleveland win in the American League, then at least they get a Chicago team, the Cubs at that. That'll make the next round in the National League. Just to get some ratings here. But bottom line is, I agree with Russo. It would have been a really tough game for the Cubs. I think they're the better team. I don't even think it's close that they're the better team. But, you know, one game, anything can happen.
And I posted this when I was putting together the rundown for the program. And one of the first thoughts was, are the Cubs a team of destiny? And then I thought, that's probably stretching it. The better question I want to ask you is, the Cubs were the perennial favorites to go to the World Series this year. I think, at least to make the playoffs for sure, but maybe possibly the perennial favorites to win the World Series, even before they signed Jason Hayward, and long before Jason Hayward had a hugely disappointing season. I mean, he looks awful. I knew that Jason Hayward's contract was a horrible signing. I don't care what the sabermetric mathematical statistical analysis guys say. Jason Hayward just isn't a superstar. I'm sorry, he's just not. You can bring out your astrophysics or your theoretical physics where you can prove that an elephant could hang off of a ledge from a flower. You can prove that with theoretical physics. You can try whatever you want with the advanced metrics. Jason Hayward is not a superstar player. And he was awful this year. That all being said and all that aside, coming into the year, I think everyone expected them to win the World Series. From what you've seen in the playoffs so far, are they by far and away the best team? Are you just willing to shrug off the fact that maybe they didn't look amazing against the Giants? Or do they get more credit because they came back in the ninth, even though they lost that game, then they came back in the ninth again and did win that game? What are your thoughts on how dominant the Cubs have been, and is this definitely their World Series to win, or is it close? Is it still up in the air?
Oh, I think it's their World Series to win. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Look at the contenders that they're going to face against. Toronto or Cleveland. Cleveland is down two starting pitchers. Maybe they get Danny Salazar back, but they're still down two starting pitchers. I don't know how they would be able to beat Boston with that pitching staff. Toronto is a dangerous. We know they can hit it. That offense is hot, and they're hot. They can certainly be dangerous, and they get that pitching staff lined up correctly. And you got Sanchez, you got Stroman. Happ has had a fantastic season. Liriano, maybe a little rebound there. I think Toronto is the one team they might worry about the most, but Toronto's going to beat Cleveland first. Who's going to make it? Washington, L.A. They're already playing another game, which means their pitching staff's going to be stretched a little bit. Cubs will be fresh. Hard to see either the Dodgers or Washington beating the Cubs, because you figure out what Scherzer's going tomorrow. Kershaw will probably pitch game two if the Dodgers win here. It's just tough. I don't like the Dodgers. I don't like that pitching staff. I mean, in a must-win game, when your number two pitch is Rich Hill, and I like Rich Hill, but come on. I mean, that's your number two here? Where's Zach Greinke? It'd be a lot more dangerous if they had Zach Greinke going here where they could match up with the Cubs. The Cubs are going to be able to stack their rotation any way they want it. Through Arrieta, Hendricks, Lackey. And Les has been unbelievable now for, 3 months? He wins every game, so he's your ace there. The other guys may not be aces. I mean, Arrieta struggled somewhat, but they're still very good, and it's deeper than Washington or L.A. So I don't see either the Nationals or Dodgers being able to beat the Cubs. I just don't see it. The only thing that I think derails the Cubs is sort of what Chris Russo said. All the pressure's on them because everyone expects them to win. So all the pressure's on them to break that curse, so at least, at the very least, get to the World Series. Maybe those players tighten up. It doesn't seem to be. I mean, you hinted at it. You actually said it. That was a devastating loss Monday night. And that's a loss that can really stick with you, and yet they come back the next night and do the exact same thing to the Giants. That's impressive. That's actually very impressive they were able to pull that off. Because I'm thinking the same thing watching the game before I heard about the Russo comments. Oh, this is not good. They're going to game five now? All the pressure on them? Could they actually lose? Yeah, that's the first thing that's going through my mind. And now I think all that pressure somewhat is gone. Yeah, you know, it's alleviated. We were able to come back. We were able to do the same thing. Still, as they were coming into the playoffs, still are now, they have a team to beat.
And did Chris Bryant prove that he is a superstar? I mean, I think he's probably the National League MVP, but he hits that home run in the one game. He gets a late hit in the other one. Is he now the leader of that team? Is he now officially a star? I mean, Anthony Rizzo's there too, but is Chris Bryant – maybe one of the three or four best players in the game? I mean, we know Trout, we know Harper. Is Bryant getting in that class now? And now that he's doing it in the playoffs, does that tell you anything, or is he just a good player and we still got a ways to go here?
I think he's a superstar, yes. So am I going to put him in the Mike Trout category? No, I wouldn't quite go there yet. Maybe he's got some more to prove, but he's certainly the team leader. Rizzo, they're both understated. You know, you don't hear about them very much. You never hear either player – you know, doing it, and Trout's, I guess, the same way. Maybe they aren't marketed well enough. You know, maybe Chicago wants to market these guys. Or baseball should market these guys, you know, better than they do right now to make them more, I don't want to say well-known. We all know who these guys are. We just market them better here. But, yes, I think they're both stars at the very least. Superstar, I mean, who do we think a superstar is? Trout, of course. Bryce Harper, who had a terrible year, but he still is. That sort of thing, okay. But either way, the Cubs are set up for years.
And you're not concerned about Aroldis Chapman, right? I mean, they tried to get two innings out of him, and he obviously blew it. Are you concerned about that? Because, again, a rough ninth inning, we saw this in Boston with Craig Kimbrel at the end of the season. Anytime the ninth inning isn't locked down and secure, people get nervous. One bad outing, are you nervous about Chapman at all? I mean, he got it done in the next day, so I don't think so. But is there reason at all for concern? Because, again, the Cubs have to win this. I mean, everything is on board. They've fully pushed in. The ninth inning of the final game is the key inning of their entire, you know, their history, you could say. And that's going to be in the hands of Mr. Chapman.
No, I'm not nervous. Like you said, it's one game, it happened. I give more credit to Connor Gillespie. I mean, that was a 102-mile-per-hour fastball here. I mean, my God, great job by them. No, if he was a soft tosser, maybe you worry about it. You know, either way, that ball's coming in at 102. I don't care if he throws it right down the middle. It's coming in at 102. All right, good luck hitting that. No, I'm not worried about Chapman. I understand he's never pitched in the playoffs before, you know, with the Reds. And, you know, maybe you're worried about that somewhat. But bottom line is, no, I'll take Chapman every day.
And Javier Baez, this is an interesting guy. We've talked about him since he was a prospect. A lot of upside, a lot of raw talent, but some limitations and some concerns about the kind of game he has. We look at that from a fantasy perspective. Yeah, but you see what he's doing now with his less athleticism. He moves around and plays everywhere on the diamond. His potential. What have you seen from Baez in these playoffs? Is this guy the next star? I mean, the Cubs have so many. Like you said, they are just loaded. But what are your thoughts on what we're finally seeing from Javier Baez? And is next year the year of Baez?
Well, that's why the Cubs are so dangerous. You think about it. They can't even find a place to play Baez every day. And he should be an everyday player. He is that good. He is talented. They were able to acquire Chapman from the Yankees to give up Gleyber Torres, and it won't hurt them a bit. Torres could be a superstar one day. Yet, once again, they have an embarrassment of riches. Just an embarrassment of riches. What Theo Epstein's done there has just been, I mean, fantastic. But that just tells you what this team is all about. That's why they'll be good for years. I do like Baez. I think he will be a star player one day, but they need to find a place for him. Second, she was a shortstop, second base, outfield. Lourdes Madden likes to move players all around. I guess in some ways, you said it earlier, I think if they had to do it all over again, Jason Hayward would not be a 200 and whatever, you know, $200 million player. Maybe Baez would be converted to the outfield earlier.
And that's one of the things about Theo Epstein. He had a lot of trouble diagnosing good free agent signings. He made a few really bad calls while in Boston. Theo Epstein is one of the best GMs in the game. He builds an organization from top to bottom better, really from bottom to top, better than probably anyone. Again, to say in the history of the game is going far. But the fact is he built up a juggernaut in Boston. He's built another one in Chicago. He's phenomenal GM. One thing he's had a problem with is signing free agents. There were a lot of them. Edgar Renteria, Julio Lugo, Carl Crawford. There were lots of free agents that he had some trouble getting. And I think it's just that analytics. They overdo the analytics and they ignore some of the other things. There's a lot of those kinds of things. Now, granted, Theo Epstein signed David Ortiz, but that was a flyer. They didn't know they were getting that. David Ortiz was really luck. They signed him for a one-year deal to platoon, which was weird. It was a lefty and lefty, but to platoon with, what's it called? The Yankees slugger's brother, Jeremy Giambi. So David Ortiz wasn't even a starter for the Red Sox when they signed him. So to say that Theo Epstein knew that he was signing a potential Hall of Famer is giving him credit that he doesn't deserve. But, I mean, to say that, you know, he doesn't do well with the free agents. I mean, that's such a minor thing, but it is one issue if you ever wanted to quibble with Theo Epstein's ability. That's the one spot where he has had a little bit of a weakness. But I'm wondering, because it seems like you could have gone in and swooped Baez. If a team wanted to go in and offer the Cubs something that they could use, not just a mediocre, but a talented player, Baez could be playing a multiple positions and batting in the middle of a lineup for somebody, and nobody wanted to take that chance. And we'll see. He's a free swinger, so we could be getting a little bit overexcited for nothing. But nonetheless, he's really showing some things for this series, and it's been phenomenal. One last point about the Cubs. I understand why Madison Bumgarner gets all that credit. I mean, he's been phenomenal in the playoffs, and he deserves all the credit in the world for being a clutch player when it matters. I don't think Lester gets anywhere near the credit he deserves. I don't think anyone sees him as a true ace, but he's been the top of a rotation guy for winning organizations who go on to win the World Series and pitched great in big, huge, meaningful games over and over and over. I don't think John Lester will ever get the kind of credit he deserves. I mean, Andy Pettitte gets a ton of credit because they won so many World Series there and how great of a pitcher he was. I don't think John Lester gets anywhere near the time of credit and hype that he deserves for what he was able to do for the Red Sox and now what he continues to do for the Cubs. I mean, when he signed them, everyone looked at it and said that was a bad contract, too much money. In Boston now, they're saying, wow, Lester's a bargain compared to Price. And it's amazing how one season and all of a sudden everything changes. All that being said, I think Lester deserves so much more credit for how good of a career he's had. And he still has a few years left. But I don't think he gets anywhere near the credit he deserves.
Yeah, I would agree. I would certainly agree there. I mean, pitching in the postseason is just it's a different animal. It truly is. We everything's magnified. You know, no one's giving up giving away at bats here. So as far as your Bumgarner part, I'm on board here. You know, David Ortiz is a completely different story. We have a whole different show on Big Poppy about how good he's been. Does he deserve to get the Hall of Fame? Is he a better DH than Edgar Martinez? The steroid thing? That's a whole show all in itself.
Just to punctuate the point, do you think Lester, if it was Game 7, or to start the series, Game 1, are you starting Lester or are you starting Arrieta? I mean, he was the runaway monster last season. To me, Lester deserves the start. I don't know. Which are you going with, Arrieta or Lester?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt here. It's Lester. I mean, you're right about Arrieta. He was a monster last season. He was good for the first couple of months this season. He was great for the first couple of months this season. Hasn't been the past couple of months. Now that he's been bad, he just hasn't been anywhere near as good as Lester. I think you know how I am, Chris. I play to win. I'm not playing to massage egos. I want to win. If I'm Joe Maddon, I want to win the World Series. And who's that player right now that you want possibly pitching three games? That's John Lester. He's done it before. He's been in the world. He's been in pressure situations. Not that Arrieta hasn't, but Lester has. He's proven that he can do it before. There's just no way I can't start John Lester. When was the last time John Lester lost the game? Anybody have this? I mean, it's been a long, long time. John Lester, pretty easily for me, starts game one.
Yeah, in a Dynasty Expert League, someone offered me Todd Frazier for John Lester, with the argument being that John Lester's old and that he's good, but he's not special. I rode John Lester to a third or fourth place finish in that league. and while Todd Frazier had a nice season as well, I just couldn't even consider doing that. I'm a big Lester guy, but not because he's a Red Sox. I really do believe that he's just really, really good. That being said, let's look ahead to the Nats and the Dodgers. Who you got for Game 5? Well, before we actually look at the game, one of the arguments was, do you go with Urias in Game 4 and do you go with Kershaw in Game 5, or do you go with Kershaw in 4 and then go with whoever the heck you're going to go with in 5? It looks like they're going to go with Rich Hill. Which way do you think the Dodgers should have played? Did they do it right? I mean, they won, but that doesn't mean they made the right decision. What are your thoughts on the decision they decided to go with going with Kershaw on short rest?
I mean, honestly, I probably – if I'm the manager, unless Kershaw can talk me into it, I said it before, starting on 3 days rest just doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't. And Kershaw pitched fine yesterday, so that wasn't the problem. I understand, you know, if you look at his final line, it was 5 runs. The bullpen gave up 3 of those runs. You know, you can make an argument that Kershaw could have gotten out of that inning. That one pitch to Bryce Harper yesterday looked like strike 3. It was certainly borderline, could have gone either way. It went against Kershaw. But the ump wasn't giving him the high strike or the low strike as the game went on. The ump had a wide strike zone early. And then, as usual in baseball, that strike zone clamps down as the game goes on. Extremely frustrating. So it did work out, but I kind of leaned the way to where I want my pitcher on 4 days rest. But then again, if you don't win yesterday, you don't have a game 5. You know, so I understand. Same thing with what Buck Showalter didn't do. You know, Dave Roberts went with his bullet in the gun. You have a Kershaw. I'm not losing when I could pitch him on 3 days rest. He may not be 100% Clayton Kershaw, but 80% is good enough for me. So I don't blame him either way. I think if the Dodgers were up 2-1, that's an easy situation. Then I'd definitely go Kershaw game 5. But down 2-1, I have no issues with Roberts going with Kershaw. I might have shied away from it, but then again, really? You go as much as we think Urias is going to be a good pitcher, still a rookie, wasn't great this year. That's a huge gamble. Up 2-1, I almost definitely do it. Down 2-1, I have no issues. In the end, if Kershaw was convincing enough, I'd have probably thrown him as well.
And I think the one thing that makes that a good decision, Joe Sheehan mentioned a comment on the other day. He thought they should have gone with Urias and gone with Kershaw in game 5 because you have to win both of them. So it's kind of like the bullpen thing is you got to get through the 8th and the 9th or in the 9th and the 10th. That was kind of his argument there. But the one thing, and you kind of poo-pooed hit Rich Hill. When Rich Hill's actually able to stay on the mound and not get blisters, he's been dominant consistently the entire season. Now, I realize, you know, he doesn't have much of a sample size over the last 5 years. But this year, when he pitches, for the most part, he's been dominant. And so by going with Kershaw on short rest, that allowed them to possibly pitch Hill tomorrow, because then they get a day off and then a game. They probably, that wouldn't have happened. If they went with Urias in game four, obviously it would have been Kershaw, and Hill would have been out of the pen. I'd rather have Kershaw and Hill, even though Kershaw's on short rest, than Urias and Kershaw and Hill out of the bullpen, which if Kershaw's going in game five, you're hoping you don't need anybody but Kershaw. So you're hoping you never even get anywhere near Rich Hill in game five as a bullpen guy. That, to me, is maybe the deciding factor. Let Kershaw go on short rest so you can go with Hill, because I'd much rather have Hill go than Julio Urias. Now, Urias is a potentially really nice pitcher, but he hasn't gone much more than five innings all season. He's been on a strict pitch count. His command has been pretty good for a rookie, but not professional, win game four of the playoffs kind of good command. So if you did go with Urias, you were going to need to work the bullpen to win that game, and I'm not so sure the Dodgers want to do that with their pen. I'm not so sure they love their pen. Not enough where, I mean, you with Urias, you kind of knew you were going to have to get at least three innings, if not four. That's my concern. So that's why I would probably lean that way, Kershaw and Hill, because Hill can go in game five. To me, that would be the deciding factor.
I mean, the only way it's solid, you do need to win both games, but I need to get to a game five first. So that's why I'm probably leaning towards why I would have pitched Kershaw at game four. Like I said, it would have all come down to my talk with Kershaw. You know, Dave Roberts, I'm assuming, knows him, he's telling the truth, knows not. And Kershaw's telling me up and down, you know, staring at me with those eyes, that he wants the ball. And you could tell he means it. He wants the ball. He gets the ball. You know, if, however, it's, I can go for you, I'm okay, then you don't get the ball. You understand that kind of talk? I need to know my pitcher there. You know, I need to know if I think he can go for it or not. Because I think your best-case scenario is sort of what happened yesterday. He went 6+ innings. I would not have brought him back out for the 7th, by the way. I thought that was a mistake. You know, I thought that while watching the games. I thought, they had somebody up in the 6th, and you were worried about if he could get through that. So I thought that might have been a mistake, giving him that extra inning there, even though I think he was at 84, 85 pitches. But to me, when you bring back somebody on 3 days' rest, you always add 20 to the pitch count. You know, that's how I've always approached that. You always add 20. So I think he's tired, a little off there. I wouldn't have brought him back out there. But that being said, I didn't have an issue with it. The bullpen really hurt the game more than Kershaw did. You got to get to game five first. Saying you have to win both, okay, that's true. But I want to make it to game five. Anything can happen in game five. You know, you have some momentum now. You won the game. Oh, they got the big hit. So you have some momentum now. Kershaw, in some ways, is on Washington because they've been another team. Obviously nowhere near what the Cubs are going through, but they've been another team that's disappointed year after year after year. You're playing at home, game five. You got your ace pitcher on the mound. You're going up against Rich Hill. Price is all on Washington to win this game.
How do you think game five is going to play out?
Well, with Sir Scherzer, it's all about whether or not he can avoid the mistake. The fastball right down the middle, that gets hit out. You know he's going to strike out his double-digit batters, but sometimes he throws the ball right down the middle, it gets hit out. If you can avoid that, keep the Dodgers with 2-3 runs, they're fine. Rich Hill has to be precise. He's not going to blow people away. He has to be precise. Has to hit his spots. So I give the edge to the Nationals, the pitching department. I think they're the better team. I think they will win the game.
Yeah, for me, it's a lot about the offense. The Nats, with Trey Turner, they've been phenomenal, and Rendon's done a little bit here in the playoffs. It looks like Bryce Harper is injured, so he's not really 100% of what he can be. That's an excuse, but that's a reality. It's 70% or whatever of Bryce Harper. But that offense has been pretty good. Jason Worth has been really good in the playoffs so far. Daniel Murphy continues to be probably one of the best signings in the offseason. He got pretty big money, but when you produce and almost win a batting title and you hit the kind of 25 home runs and kind of carried the team in the first half, that offense coming together, you combine that with the fact that you've got the best pitcher on the mound, that seems to be an overwhelming advantage to them, and they get to play at home, which I want to ask you about, transitioning over to the American League. The Rangers got swept with home field advantage. The Red Sox got swept without it. Is home field matter? I always thought of home field as the fifth game. If you have that must-win game five, you want to be at home. But I've always thought that home field didn't matter. I just said, look, I want to be at home in game five, but I really don't think it actually matters. And I think the numbers prove that, is that for the most part, the home team and the away team almost win evenly. So there's no statistical advantage to having that home field. But I started to think about it. It does dictate how the series goes. When you come back to Boston down 0-2, even though you've got two games and you can win two at home, the pressure is on you. I mean, game one is nowhere near as pressure-filled as game three if you're down 0-2. So it almost feels like home field matters only in that you can dictate how things go. But that being said, it went all the wrong way for the Rangers. So that argument seems to not be able to hold up water either way there. What are your thoughts on home field when it comes to this division series?
I think home field does matter somewhat. You know, Toronto and Cleveland, I think those are two big home field advantages. We know Toronto, those fans are nuts. You know, you're playing in a ballpark where the ball flies out on official turf. So I think home field does matter there, yes. Cleveland, the fans can go pretty crazy there as well. It'll be cold, more than likely, so that could play a factor in it, have a player handle that cold weather. I think Cleveland would handle it a little bit better than that. But in the end, it comes down to the better team, right? So that's the way it is. You can say home field advantage, maybe the last leg, sorry, I got to do this, get to that. In the end, it comes down to the better team here. So I think everything's pointing Toronto's way here because I think Skydome actually plays a more important role here as far as the home ballpark than Jacobs Field. Whatever they call that, Progressive Field. Now I kind of can't keep up with all these name changes. So I think that matters there. But overall, I think Toronto's a better team. I might feel completely different about this if Carrasco and Salazar were healthy. I'm shocked. Out of all the playoff games so far, I can't believe Cleveland swept Boston. I had both Boston going to the World Series. And not that I'm shocked that Cleveland beat them. It's just how they swept them. They swept them and how they won the games. If you would have told me all the games were 9-8 and Cleveland has outslugged Boston, all right. You know, that happens. But the fact that they were losing, where Boston could hit Tomlin. You know, I mean, come on, Bauer. Come on. That can't happen here. I mean, it looks like Andrew Miller and Cody Allen are pitching six innings a game, although it seemed that way. So just really surprised. That was very impressive by Cleveland to do what they did.
Yeah, I talked about before how you can't criticize John Farrell for putting Brock Holt in batting second, and then it turns out that it worked out, and he was your best hitter for the series. You got to give him some credit, even though you can't bash him for doing it and then bash him for it working at the same time. But I do think John Farrell deserves some blame here because the Red Sox won 11 in a row. They clinched the playoffs against the New York Yankees, and the moment that they knew they were in the playoffs, they folded completely. Not only did they lose games, but literally they folded in the inning that they found out. When Teixeira hit that walk-off home run, the Red Sox knew they were in the playoffs. You could see the owners slapping each other five in the front row at Yankee Stadium before that ninth inning because they found out they had made the playoffs. And the whole team just wilted. They knew that they had made it, and they stopped even caring. Now, granted, I can understand that. You're in the playoffs. You release a little bit. You achieved something. But then they went in and they lost 5 of 6, I think, to finish the season, or 3 out of 4. And then obviously they lost 3 in a row in the playoffs. They never got it back together. And I think John Farrell deserves some criticism for that. He let them coast at the end. They did all of that David Ortiz celebration crap. I can see how that would be a nuisance. I think John Farrell deserves a little blame for the fact that his team just wilted, just went to sleep and said, hey, we've reached the mountaintop. There's nothing left to achieve. And that rolled right into the playoffs. Porcello didn't pitch well, one of his worst outings of the entire season. David Price has always been bad in the postseason, but he went back to pitching the mediocre way that he did in the regular season. The bats didn't hit at all. Their approach against the Indians, they talked about this a lot up here in Boston. Tomlin throws strikes like nobody's business, and that's part of his weakness. His stuff is so mediocre that he throws strikes with mediocre stuff, so he sometimes – when teams are taking him, then he succeeds because he gets ahead in the count and then all of a sudden he gets a little bit difficult. But if you're swinging, he's throwing meat up there. This guy just doesn't have very good stuff. Well, the Red Sox just took the first pitch over and over and over and over again. So they forced themselves to be behind every single time they were up there against Tomlin, and they just rolled over. I mean, I think Farrell deserves a lot of punishment for that, and that's part of the reason. I do wonder about this Indians team. Do you think they're good? You said you like the Jays, but could this just be a magical season? Does the managers matter? Gibbons versus Francona, is that going to make a factor? Is this going to be an easy series for the Jays, or do you think this one's a tight one where you do believe that it's a 48-52 kind of thing? How good is this series going to be?
I thought Boston would go through Cleveland pretty easy. So I'm going to say the same thing about Toronto. I think they should go through Cleveland pretty easy. I think Francona is the better manager. but I don't know how much that really matters in baseball. This is not football. This is not Bill Belichick designing game plans to stop your team. You know, where you know if Bill Belichick is worth 7 to 10 points a game. You know, this is baseball. You play yourself to perform. Other teams better start your pitching, better hitters. You're going to have a tough time. Like I said, if Cleveland were healthy, I feel different about this, but they're not. They're beat up. Salazar may come back, but as a reliever, not as a starter, which is great, but how are you going to win a 7-game series with Tomlin, Bauer, Kluber? Who's your fourth starter? You can't get through with three like you did in the first, the 5-game series. Yeah, I can't see it, Chris. I can't see Cleveland pulling this off. I'm tempted to say Toronto in 5, but I'll go Toronto in 6.
Now, you said the biggest shock was that the Red Sox lost, so I guess it has to be the biggest shock that they got swept. What about the fact that the Rangers got swept? And granted, the Jays are playing well, but the Rangers had the best record in the American League. Was that a shocker? Was it a surprise? Or did you think the Jays were going to win, but just it would be a little bit closer? What were your thoughts on what happened with the Rangers? Because they went down just as easily as the Red Sox did.
Well, I guess if you believe in jinxes, you should be happy. That if you're a Cleveland fan, you should be happy right about now. Because I don't think I've won any series in the American League. I had Texas winning in 5 against Toronto, so I was wrong there. They did go down pretty immediately. I never thought Texas was the best team in the American League. I didn't see that. But it was going to be Hamilton, Darvish. You knew they had no chance in Game 3 when you're throwing out Colby Lewis. I mean, come on, that's pretty much putting up the white flag. If anything, I might have said, I guess you can't even do that. He would have got, yeah, when that's your third starter, you really don't have much. I just thought they would have hit a little better. You know, maybe could have dragged it where they could have gotten to Game 4 and Game 5 and used Darvish and Hamels again. Didn't work out that way. I think when it comes to Texas, I was wrong. I thought they would hit. They didn't. I thought they would get to that bullpen. It would help a little bit. I think Toronto may be a better team than I was giving them credit for. You know, that pitching staff is solid. Maybe we were down on Toronto a little bit because they didn't hit in September. You know, for as good a hitting team as they were, they disappeared in September. Yeah, maybe I don't know why that is. And Bautista wasn't doing much, and Encarnacion was solid. Tulowitzki's up and down. Josh Donaldson had a hip injury, so he was hurt. And that now they've turned it up again in October. So that's, you know, it's a great thing for them. I think they're extremely dangerous right now. That pitching staff is better than we've given them credit for. I already went through the names. And I was surprised in the 1-game playoff that Toronto, Gibbons got so much. They got some slack for starting Stroman. I really thought that was a no-brainer. That's easily the pitcher I would have started against Baltimore with Stroman. I think he is a pretty good. He's not an ace. He's not Max Scherzer or Clayton Kershaw, but he's pretty good. I had no problem starting Stroman in that game. But Stroman, Sanchez, Happ, Liriano, good bullpen with Assun who can go multiple innings if necessary. I'm going to have a hard time not picking the Jays. I think the Jays are a better team. I also think, Jays, if it's Jays and Cubs.
Yeah, that would be an interesting series. I had a hard time buying into the Rangers. They're a good team, but they're kind of a team that's spread out amongst a whole bunch of players. You don't look at them and say, wow, that's Donaldson, Bautista, and Encarnacion, bang, 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 and then Tulo, who is still a pretty good hitter. He's not the Rockies in Coors Field Tulowitzki that we knew of him as a superstar, but he's still a decent player. You know, you look at the Jays and say, wow, the Rangers don't have that 1-2-3, bang, bang, bang. And so because of that, I had a hard time buying in. The one thing that I would always sat on and said, wait a second, Hamels and Darvish can be shutdown guys. But again, I'm not a big Hamels guy. There was a lot of talk when he was being traded by the Phillies that the Red Sox should not trade for them. They should not pay the hefty price to get Hamels because in the American League East, he's just going to struggle. He's going to be a good pitcher, but he's not going to be that dominant guy that he was in Philly. And you can avoid that a little bit pitching in Texas. I wonder if that's part of it. I wonder if Hamels struggled because once you go into those really meaty American League East lineups, maybe a guy like Hamels who doesn't have plus velocity kind of lives and dies by the changeup. Maybe that's part of it. Is that once he faces those big lineups, he's not the dominant number one guy that the Rangers kind of traded for. I agree. I had a hard time buying into the Rangers as being even one of the top 3 or 4 teams. I didn't really know who to predict in that series, but I definitely wasn't fully buying into believing that the Rangers are a great team. I never thought that.
Yeah, me either. I'm so surprised that the Rangers had the record they had, but they played great when they needed it. Those they beat the crap out of the Houston Astros every game they played them this season, it seemed like. But other than that, you know, you see them, you know, I don't see that. I just never saw them as a great team. You know, Darvish, Hamels, okay. Solid. Hamels is a good pitcher, but not of the ilk of Scherzer or, you know, Kershaw or all the other aces we know throughout baseball. And after that, their pitching staff is okay at best. Nothing fancy there. The lineup is good, but not, I wouldn't call it a great lineup, even in that ballpark. So they were, I guess, with the definition of a better team, you know, better overall team than as far as a great team. But, hey, they're gone. You heard John Daniels, the GM, come out today and say he will do all he can to make that rotation better next year. He actually came out and said, we have the prospects to do this. That lets you know that they're going to be on the trade market. Maybe that Chris Sale trade will be revived.
That'll be interesting because I expect that to be a pretty costly trade, but there are a couple of organizations that can do it if they want to do it. You wonder if the Red Sox will be willing after this disappointing playoff run, if they're willing to give up the prospects that it would take to get a Chris Sale. So there could be a bidding war for a guy that was already extremely expensive as it is. So that it'll definitely be an interesting winter once we get through these playoffs here. You picked the Jays over the Indians, and I think I have to agree with you on paper. The Indians are more of a Cinderella, you know, magical season kind of thing. If they're going to win, they're going to win with less. So I think you have to pick them as the underdog no matter who they face all along. So I completely buy in and agree with you when it comes to you got to go with the Jays. And the Jays have some interesting starting pitchers too. Jay has pitching better than you would have expected. Sanchez really is kind of nasty. He's got some pretty good stuff. Stroman has his goods and his bads. I can see why people aren't big on him, but I could see your kind of positive comments about him as well. Looking at the National League, and we'll get out of here real quickly. If the Dodgers win, how do you think they do, or how do things go, or how do the Dodgers find a way to beat the Cubs? And then same thing for the Nats. If the Nats win, how do they go about and beat the Cubs?
Well, I don't think either team is going to beat the Cubs. So I've already said I have the Cubs beating whoever comes out of Washington. Dodgers tomorrow, I have Washington winning that game. It'll be tough because, once again, no Strasburg. He's already had the shoulder discomfort again, so he's done for this season. Scherzer won't be able to pitch, Saturday, Sunday. He's pitching Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. He'll be able to pitch game three at best. So he's going at most twice in the series, game three and game seven. I don't know if he'll get to game seven. That's a whole lot of Gio Gonzalez, Tanner Roark, and Joe Ross. And I like Roark. I like Ross. I like Gonzalez to a degree as well, but that doesn't match up well with Chicago. You know, I think Washington's overmatched here without Strasburg. Unlucky for them that he's out again, so I don't think they can do it. And the Dodgers are going to have the same exact problem, other than Kershaw could probably go game two. But after that, they have a whole lot of iffiness in their rotation. Yeah, so it's just, they just don't have enough pitching. Neither team has enough pitching to hold up with the Cubs. I don't think either one could beat them. And it's not like either one has a great offense to match up with the Cubs either. Cubs don't have any weaknesses. It's the bottom line. They don't have any weaknesses. I have the Cubs beating either team. Once again, I probably would like to say five, but I'll go six either way.
Yeah, it's hard to pick against them, even if you believe they're vulnerable. Chris Russo mentioned that today. We keep quoting the mad dog, the crazy one. But his basic point today was that the Cubs took advantage of a mediocre National League. And while the Cubs are a good team, he acknowledged they're a good team, but they're not a great team. And he compared it to some of those Yankees teams and some of the best teams of all time. He said this team isn't anywhere near that. They're just bashing up on some decent but not great clubs. I don't know if I believe that or not, but it is tough. You look at them, again, with how much I like Lester, with how serviceable Lackey is, and then you got Arrieta, and their pitching staff is good. They've got Chapman at the back, and offensively they do a lot of really good things. And let me ask you real quick. We'll get out of here, but Alvin Amora made that phenomenal catch against the Giants in game four, or game three. Jason Hayward was relieved for defense? I mean, isn't that part of why his WAR is so high? Did that kind of shock you a little bit? Or, I mean, Jason Hayward gets all that money and then he gets removed? That's why I'm asking. It kind of scratches my head a little bit there.
Yeah, there was no injury involved. That was strange. That's the one metric where Jason Hayward does great out well in is his defense. Certainly still doesn't justify his contract. But, yes, I thought that was strange as well. Maybe there was an injury we didn't know about there.
All right, that's George Kurtz from RotoExperts.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at George Kurtz. George, thanks a lot for joining us today. Look forward to talking more baseball with you as we get moving along in the playoffs. But have a good day. Enjoy your NHL hockey tonight.
Woohoo! Yeah, looking forward to it. First game, 7 o'clock Eastern.
All right, everybody, that's our program for today here on a podcast to be named later. He is George Kurtz. Again, you can follow him on Twitter, at George Kurtz. You can read his content over at RotoExperts.com. I'm Chris Mitchell. You can read my content at rotoexperts.com, or you can also go over to minorleagueball.com, which is where these podcasts are actually posted. I also write some articles over there and post some blog postings. had a little bit of a heated debate last week, actually, with a bunch of Rockies fans. They did not believe in my point that DJ LeMahieu delegitimized his batting crown by sitting out for a week. In total Bush League garbage. And I said it probably a little overzealously because I did go a little bit aggressive on it. And I kind of freely admit that. But it doesn't change the fact that I was right. He did delegitimize the fact that he won the batting crown. When you monitor another player and you sit out because you're afraid that by playing you'll hurt your chances of winning something, that is complete and total garbage. It's total Bush League. And I maybe was a little bit overcritical of DJ LeMahieu because it's not really, at the end of the day, his decision. But I didn't hear a whole lot of uproar from him complaining that they weren't letting him play. Now, maybe he's a nice guy. He's a team guy. Nonetheless, if you agree with a decision and don't voice complaints, and voice them strongly, not just a little whimper like, oh, please, I want to play. If you don't go out there and actually tell them, look, I got to go out and earn this thing, you're making me look like a coward, because that's what it does. That it looks like he's a coward. Granted, if he has no input and he absolutely could not have changed their mind, then he had no input and he couldn't change their mind. I understand that. I'm not going to call the guy a coward if that's what happened. But from what we're looking, from the outside looking in, we didn't see anything to tell us that he absolutely, with all of his heart, wanted to play. It looks like he accepted it. They sat him for essentially a week. He had 6 at-bats in the final 6 games. Almost a full week. That's almost 6 games is 1 short of 7. And so he sat out for an entire week so that they could strategically play the matchups and say, okay, Murphy's not playing tonight. No reason for you to play. Murphy's not playing tonight. We don't want you to get in the at-bats and hurt yourself. You're not going out there. They removed him halfway through another game. I suspect they were doing the math, and they planned this out probably 2 weeks in advance. And said, look, we got to play the numbers and see what this kid has to do to maintain his average and not put himself in a statistical disadvantage to maintaining his batting average and winning the crown. They had to have been doing that. So this was a plan. This may have been 2 or 3 weeks in advance. They were probably running the numbers and saying, okay, what do we do here? I mean, that's pathetic. It is down and out pathetic that they were actually putting thought in strategy, and they probably brought in the statistical analysis guys from their organization and said, what do we need to do to make sure he wins this thing? I mean, there was time and effort and thought put into this strategy, all so that you could avoid having to earn the batting crown. I mean, that is just so pathetic. Now, granted, the last 6 games of the year, so for 156 of the games, he went all the way out there and earned it, but so that doesn't mean he doesn't deserve to win the batting title. But you did tarnish it by doing what you did for the final 6. You did. You delegitimized it. You won by 1 point. 348 to 347. You won by 1 point. So it's not like it was over. It's not like you had the title and the last week was meaningless and you were letting some other guys play and giving your veterans a rest. That's not what happened here. They strategically planned to make sure he won that title. Or more importantly, they strategically planned to make sure he didn't blow it, so he didn't choke. That's what they did. And to me, that is just pathetic. To me, that is just outright pathetic. And again, if DJ did everything he could and fully throated his complaints and said, I want to play, then I'm not blaming him at all. But I've heard no evidence to suggest that he was that strongly behind against this decision. So since and I can understand why he wouldn't be. You don't want to come out and bash your organization. But the fact is, if you don't voice a complaint strongly, then there's no other conclusion that we can draw. All we can take is the evidence we have. And the evidence is that he accepted it and he was okay with it. And we don't know anything. We don't know if it was Walt Weiss. We don't know if it was management. We don't know if it was dictated from the top or Walt Weiss was doing this for his player or he thought he was doing him a solid when really he was doing him a disservice. So Walt Weiss, if he had to do with the decision, and if he was in favor of it, he's just the dumbest manager I've ever come across. You are doing a complete and total disservice to your player by making him look like this. He looks awful. I don't think anyone can disagree with that. If you're a Rockies fan, you still have to admit it doesn't look good. You can justify it. You can say, oh, it's no big deal. And I've had people on the show who said that. They said, oh, it's no big deal. Other players have done it. Jose Reyes sat out, I think, a game, one game. He had won the batting title with, I think, a single earlier in the game or something. And then he removed himself so he didn't blow it the rest of the game. Now, that's, in principle, the same thing as what LeMahieu did. But it's so much smaller that it is so much less significant. You didn't tarnish an entire season by taking off a half a game. But when you plan ahead and you sit out the majority of six games, six at-bats in six games, yes, that is significantly more than Jose Reyes sitting out a half a game in order to protect his lead. I don't even know if I'd consider Reyes the same, but it's still a little bit weak. You know, Reyes would have had two or three more bats and he could have blown it. I would have rather seen Reyes go in and finish that game and earn it. But that's one game. I actually don't have that big of a problem there because it's not as much the principle. It's how far the Rockies went that makes it that much more disgusting. A week. He sat out a week. I mean, give me a break. He sat out almost an entire week to win this thing. That is just that's just a joke. That is a complete and utter joke. It's just – and on top of that, let me just throw out a minor point to this. Three of those games that LeMahieu played portions or didn't play at all were against the Giants. He had six at-bats in the final six games. The last three were against the Brewers, so there was no playoff implications there. But he played on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday against the Giants, and they were fighting tooth and nail to make the wild card game. So the Rockies left one of their best players on the bench to win a batting crown at the detriment, possibly, of the St. Louis Cardinals. I mean, think about that. That makes it that much more pathetic. Not only did you make your player look bad, it made him look like he was running from a challenge. It made him look like a coward. And it made it look like you were afraid of what was going to happen. You didn't want him to go out and prove he's a great player and win this thing and grab it by the horns. You said, oh my goodness, this guy's going to choke it away and we got to protect him before he does it. That's the mindset of what's going on here. And that's coming from management. That's coming from the manager. And if the player doesn't voice his complaints, he's admitting that at least to some degree, he's a little bit concerned about it too. And it's also admitting that this award is somehow a big deal. The Nationals and Daniel Murphy actually deserve credit. One of the arguments that the Rockies fans who were hating on me on Twitter were making was that Daniel Murphy sat out also, that he had fewer at-bats during the second half. Some idiot said that I lack intellectual curiosity because I didn't buy into his argument that the fact that LeMahieu sat out didn't delegitimize his batting title, because he had more at-bats than Murphy, and because Murphy sat out at the end also. What a moronic comment. But nonetheless, I didn't even respond to it. It was so stupid, I didn't even have to respond to it. Daniel Murphy sat out because he was injured. Now, if the Nationals were in a pennant race still, if they hadn't clinched it, he would have played. So it wasn't a major injury. He didn't break his leg. He didn't sit out because he had a broken leg. But the priority should be the playoffs. The batting crown isn't even that big of an award. It's great that he won it. Congratulations. But it's not this enormous thing where it doesn't matter how you win it. All that matters is that you do. Not at all. How you go about winning it is more important than whether you won it or not. So that's pathetic in and of itself. But the Nationals actually said, you know what? Sorry, Daniel Murphy. We know that you have a chance to win this batting title, and we'd like it if you could win it. But you being healthy is more important for the playoffs, for the franchise. The goal is to win the World Series. We're not going to throw you out there to win a batting title and possibly get you more injured or possibly have you tired for when the playoffs come around. We need you fully at 100% and rested for the playoffs. And so you have to sacrifice the batting crown. That's essentially what they did. They said you have to sacrifice the batting crown for the betterment of the Nationals. They deserve credit for that. And yet these Rockies fans are telling me that Daniel Murphy should be criticized for sitting out, and that it actually bolsters LeMahieu's claim because Murphy sat out. Totally moronic. I mean, how dumb can you be? If LeMahieu was sitting for that reason, I'd be on board. If the Rockies were ever going to have a chance at the playoffs, which they won't. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not a Rockies hater, but you play in Coors Field. LeMahieu was in the batting title race because he plays half his games at Coors Field. That's just a fact. I know you guys hate hearing that. I know that this is this thing that just eats you alive, but Major League Baseball and the Rockies organization, they sold their soul for the devil. You should not have a team. Let's face it. The Rockies need to have a humidifier, the humidor, in order to even play games in Major League Baseball. They need to somehow find a way to not enhance the ball, but to reduce it, which is the exact opposite of what baseball is doing. There have been comments across baseball that they juiced the balls this year in order to up the number of home runs. Because as you all know, quote unquote, chicks dig the long ball. I don't know if the ball's juiced. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I think they juice the ball every once in a while. I think there have been some years where they've juiced the ball. When you play in other ballparks, the ball is juiced. When you play in Coors Field, you actually have to weigh the thing down to keep it in the field. So LeMahieu benefits significantly from his home park. So that almost delegitimizes it in and of itself. You look at the home road factors, and that alone almost delegitimizes LeMahieu winning the batting crown anyway. But I'm not even going to get into that. That would take a lot of statistical analysis, and I didn't do that because this was purely an argument about how you play the game. That was the argument. You play the game to win. It's a competitive game. And more importantly, it's a game. If LeMahieu sitting out meant that his life would be saved, if he lost the batting crown and therefore he'd be dead, you know, if you lose the batting crown, we are going to hang you. Okay, it's life or death. Life is more important than death, so however you survive, you survive. I'm okay with that. You don't delegitimize life by sitting out. But it is a batting crown. It is a freaking batting crown. Go about it the right way. And nobody can even argue that the Rockies and Walt Weiss and DJ LeMahieu did it the right way. Nobody can argue that. Now, if you want to argue how big of a deal this is me writing about it and then now ranting about it, overdoing it, am I making more out of it than it is? That's a possibility. That definitely, you can make that argument. There's a valid argument to be had there. I'm just kind of disgusted. When I look at how pathetic this looks, it just disgusts me. Because there's no reason not to do things the right way in this circumstance. Because the consequences are so minor. There's nothing really on the line. So it's easy to be honorable when there's no consequence of being honorable. It's like a congressman making a stand on a vote when the vote is already decided or when you know you're going to lose. The stance doesn't mean anything when you do that. Making a meaningless stand is just that. It is meaningless. That's essentially what it was here. If LeMahieu played right down to the end, it would have been a good story, and it would have been a great year. He's had a really great year, an unexpected year, one of the better stories that unfortunately went mostly unnoticed all season long. Nobody talked about DJ LeMahieu all season long, and that's a shame because he deserved it. He had a phenomenal season, and he's also, from what Rockies fans are telling me, a great defender too. I don't see a lot of Rockies games, so I'll just outright say I'm not fully and thoroughly vetted on DJ LeMahieu's full skill sets and abilities. I do know who he is, even though a bunch of fans also tried to accuse me of that, saying I've never heard of the guy until this week. Yeah, I've had DJ LeMahieu on my fantasy teams in the past. I know exactly who he is. He's got a whole ton of vowels in his name. You can't help but see him. It's just pathetic. It's just pathetic that they would go through this. And to think about it, I mean, they played the St. Louis Cardinals on the 21st of the month. I bet that right around there, or maybe even a little bit earlier, they were probably looking and saying, okay, there's this many at-bats, this many games remaining in the season, and we got to start to monitor Murphy. We got to start monitoring how LeMahieu's hitting. We got to run some statistical analysis to figure out how many hits he needs in order to maintain the average, in order to be able to win. I'm sure they were doing that kind of analysis. So going all the way back to probably – you know, September 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st. That was a week and a half before the season was over. That's probably when they were planning this thing, thinking about this thing, modeling out what were the potential outcomes. I have no doubt that they were doing that. I'm not a conspiracy guy, but this was planned ahead. Once they faced the Giants on Tuesday, September 27th, the fix was in. That's when this conspiracy began. That is when they decided we have to reduce his at-bats in order to guarantee that he wins it. He sat, I'd have to go back to double-check, but I believe the 27th was the day that against the Giants where they pulled him early. Then he played against the Giants, I believe, on the 28th, and then he didn't on the 29th. Something in that neighborhood. I'd have to pull up the exact games again because I didn't memorize this thing. It wasn't as big of a deal as I seem to be making. But that they spent that kind of effort and time looking into this and then went through with it. It's just, it's pathetic. There's no argument to that. As I said, the only argument is how big of a deal is it? This happens, make that big of a deal. Maybe it doesn't. But to me, there's no doubt that my article was correct. He delegitimized the batting title. It's just how much did he delegitimize it? Was it relatively minor? Was it an afterthought? Or was it kind of a big deal? The media is mostly ignoring it. I'm kind of back on it now because someone in the New York Post wrote an article about it over the weekend. So I did this a week and a half ago. Someone wrote an article on Thursday or Friday of last week. I wrote it on Monday or Tuesday of that. So I was a few days ahead. But the media doesn't seem to care. No one talked about it. And let's face it, the media mostly, when they can, wants to be positive. You'll see some negative stories out in the media as well because you want to get attention. There are writers that will do that. I did not write this for that, but I've been accused of it. But you will see some negative comments, but it's pretty uncommon. Keith Law wrote a very scathing article about the Diamondbacks and how horrible their management has been. And you're seeing a whole bunch of them being fired. But that's pretty rare. Keith Law doesn't do that very often. Very few writers want to come out and be overly negative. So I can see why this LeMahieu story hasn't been talked about. Calling this cowardice and saying it's pathetic and kind of disgusting and it's kind of against the honor of the game, which are all true. The tone of that isn't an article that a lot of people want to be writing about, and it doesn't help with access either for that matter. But anyway, that's my little rant for the day. Thanks everybody for tuning in for baseball talk. We're going to do more of it hopefully in the next few days. We're going to be talking football as well if you want to follow my podcast over there. Again, I'm Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later. You can follow me on Twitter at CJMitch73, or you can follow all my writings and my baseball podcast over at minorleagueball.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Enjoy your weekend. Enjoy hockey. Up and running. October 12th, hockey's in the go. Love hockey.